Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. And this is Mike Fader with The Turning Point. I'm just adjusting the volume here. Just showed up late because a lot of traffic today, and I just walked in, so I have to do a little technical adjustments here. Radio, absolute radio. Those of you who responded to the interview last week, and if you didn't hear the interviews last week, for the first time in about a year and a half, I decided to do some interviews, as I used to do quite often. And they were about the United States in Afghanistan, United States military forces in Afghanistan. One of them was with the leader of a group called Veterans for Peace, who, like a lot of other people, want the U.S. to be out of there, every last boot, every last weapon, every last soldier, everything, every last K-ration, whatever they call it these days, out, because it's useless. We're not doing any good, and we often do a lot of harm. Then I spoke to somebody who's the head of Women for Afghan Women. And I was talking to her, and she was in Kabul when I was talking to her, and she said without the U.S. military forces there, women throughout Afghanistan are doomed because the Taliban will take right over, and the first thing they're going to do is arrest, torture, execute, burn down, and loot any facility or person has to do with the liberating women. So two different points of view there. And recently, as you may have noticed, Obama decided that he's going to keep troops there even longer for whatever various reasons he's keeping them there. I don't know. Maybe that's one of them, but I don't know why he wants to keep troops there longer or even increase the amount of troops. So we're in a perpetual war everywhere on Earth, I guess. Anyhow, those of you who haven't heard it, check that out. You can go to prn.fm and just go to the archives for the Turning Point, and you'll hear that show from last week. This week, we're also going to interview somebody. We have recently, for the last long time, been concerned about our criminal justice system, if justice is the right word. And to even define what justice is, there are people who were locked up forever for their mandatory minimums. Basically, the state has taken over every part of this, and the victims of crimes and the perpetrators of crimes, the criminals, once convicted or taken pleas, are taken right out of it. In other words, once a crime occurs, you have to have the state getting involved, but the state gets so involved that the victims and the perpetrators are forever separated. There's no way that they could ever, especially the victims of crimes, have any kind of input, and they could never meet. They could never meet with each other, although I'm sure that happens once in a while, but they can never meet with each other and try to figure out not only to mitigate the punishment or to go along with the punishment that the state would dole out for serious crimes, but also maybe even if this thing was established, this procedure of people working together as people rather than the state constantly involved in setting rules, maybe it would even prevent crimes from taking place. I don't know. Maybe that's idealistic. But we have with us somebody who wants to change the way the justice system works now, the impersonal way the justice system works now, and our current system of crime and punishment. Her name is Mika Dashman, and she is the founder and lead organizer for something called the Restorative Justice Initiative. Hi, are you there?
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Yes, I'm here.
Sorry, we're a little late. New York City could explain it all, traffic and everything else. What is, briefly, the Restorative Justice Initiative?
So the Restorative Justice Initiative is a citywide, New York City-based, citywide cross-sector advocacy program.
Cross what?
Cross-sector.
Cross-sector.
So what I mean when I say cross-sector is that restorative justice is a process that you'll hear about in this country in being practiced in different settings. So you'll hear about it in the context of the criminal justice system, but you'll also hear it in the context of the educational system. It's something that's used as an alternative to punitive zero-tolerance disciplinary policies in schools. It's also used proactively for community building in schools. And it's used in community-based organizations as well as a community building and conflict resolution tool. So right now, there are people all across the country working in those different sectors using the principles and the practices of restorative justice, and there are people in New York City in those different sectors using the principles and practices of restorative justice.
When you say restorative, that means that something has been, something existed once and either degraded or disappeared, and you want to restore it. So what about justice in this country are you restoring?
So I think that practitioners of restorative justice differ on what is being restored. My perspective on it is that what's being restored is the relational aspect of our lives. So we're the focus of restorative justice is on relationships between people and harm that's occurred between people. So in a restorative justice process, you're addressing the people directly involved or addressing that harm.
Rather than going straight to an authority or some rule or a law, right? You're getting people back involved.
Right. I mean, the premise of our current criminal justice system is that when a crime occurs, it's a crime against the state or against the community in a sort of large and abstract sense. But the people who are directly impacted by the crime, particularly if it's a violent crime, are largely shut out of the process once an arrest is made. So this restorative justice brings the victim or victims of the crime or the harmed party back into the process and really allows them an opportunity to talk about how they were impacted and ask for what they need for healing and reconciliation.
So doesn't sometimes when a court, I mean, the only thing that I can think of is sometimes doesn't the court ask a family, especially during after sentencing for a violent crime, if they have anything to say before a sentence is handed down? Does that happen sometimes, or is that just from the movies?
No, that happens. There are a number of jurisdictions where victims are given the opportunity to make victim impact statements. That is something that can happen in New York. And, you know, the premise is that before making a determination about sentencing, the judge will take into consideration whatever it is that the victim or the victim's families have to say. But it's still ultimately the judge who sits in a position of power and authority over the folks who were directly impacted who's making the decision about what punishment is being meted out.
What is, if you just tuned in, we're talking to Mika Dashman, and she's the founder and lead organizer for the Restorative Justice Initiative. And you have a website, right?
Yes, it's www.restorativejustice.nyc.
Okay. So what is your training and background, briefly, and in the law, and how did you arrive at doing this?
Well, I went to law school because I wanted to do social justice work, and I saw a law degree as a means to that end. I wasn't sure entering law school if I wanted to actually practice law, but I did end up practicing law for 8 years after graduating from CUNY Law School here in New York. And I worked as a civil litigator. Before I went to law school, I spent a year working as a criminal defense investigator, and that left me feeling like I didn't really want to work within the criminal justice system as a lawyer. I felt like the system wasn't working well for anybody involved, and I couldn't see myself playing any of the roles that I saw lawyers playing in that system. So I ended up working as a civil litigator and representing low-income and indigent clients in eviction proceedings and housing court and doing public benefits advocacy. But I was always looking for something else. I knew that litigation wasn't ultimately my calling. It didn't really fit with my values. It wasn't the way that I wanted to be interacting with people and resolving conflict. I felt that everybody ultimately was very compromised in the process of litigation. You know, most cases settle. There's no trial, so there's no ultimate determination of who's right, who's wrong, winner and loser. And in that settlement process, you know, everybody is compromised. And a lot of needs go unmet. Primarily, the person who was wronged never feels like they have the harm. They never feel like they have the impact on them acknowledged, and they certainly never get an apology from the person who harmed them. And I thought that was a real loss. And so I got into alternative dispute resolution. I trained as a mediator, and I did community mediation. But I didn't really find the thing that really interested me in the realm of alternative dispute resolution until I discovered restorative justice in the context of the criminal justice system. And I just, when I learned about restorative justice and specifically victim-offender dialogue in crimes of severe violence, I thought, wow, if this kind of thing could happen in the criminal justice system where the people directly impacted can come together and talk about the harm make things right, then there's hope for this system. There's hope for really transforming the system in a radical way.
The idea of restorative justice, for people talking to each other, the idea of apology and forgiveness, I mean, that's not a new idea. I mean, it seems to me that's a very old idea, but it seems to have gotten lost. Or on the other hand, it's a parallel idea with another kind of way that the world always, or most of the world has always looked at justice, which is an eye for an eye. The whole idea of revenge, feuds, and in Afghanistan, the United States was proposing, I think, to pay blood money, what that's called blood money, to payments to families, you know, about the Doctors Without Borders bombing, the hospital bombing. So what you're talking about, is that like an ancient idea of people getting together to, without the state, you know, imposing things or with their large club in the background? And here's two questions at once. Doesn't the state have an interest in protecting the rest of society? I mean, there are certain basic rules that have to be observed of civilization. I mean, if you commit a rape or a murder or some awful crime, the state does have to, in fact, like the average citizen doesn't have the tools to punish the perpetrator of a crime. And often these people who do these crimes are people who have done this before and might do it again. So the state does have to get involved, doesn't it?
Okay, I'll answer the last part of the question first.
Okay.
Yes, the state does have an interest, of course. But I would ask another question in response to that, which is, how well is the state doing what the criminal justice system has set out to do at this point in time? I think it's pretty clear that if the goal of the system is reducing recidivism and creating deterrence, if the goal of punishment is to create a deterrent to prevent people from breaking laws and committing crimes, we're not doing a very good job with our existing structure. So I think the time is ripe for investigating alternatives. And you're correct when you say that this is a very old idea. Indigenous cultures from around the world have been coming together, sitting in circles frequently to discuss harms and incidents of violence and conflict in their communities and resolving them communally for many, many years. So what is known as the restorative justice movement internationally, what that term has been around since the late 70s, early 80s, and that term was adopted based on borrowing heavily from these indigenous practices.
Well, when you say indigenous, I mean, that has a certain connotation, but I mean, isn't the whole idea or one of the ideas of Christianity forgiveness? In other words, there is something called Christian arbitration, which is parallel with the justice system sometimes, too, where people who have committed crimes, civil, I don't know, maybe others, the whole idea is to forgive other people and not to seek vengeance. Isn't it? I mean, so it's not just indigenous cultures. It's like a sort of a universal idea that's been around in different religions and cultures for a long time.
Right? Oh, yes, that's true. That is a Christian value. But as you pointed out, the Bible also talks about an eye for an eye. But it is worth noting that a lot of people in the faith community, particularly the Christian community these days, are very supportive of restorative justice programs. And I do want to mention that one of the reasons why I formed this advocacy group in New York City is because New York City is an area where there's not a whole lot happening with restorative justice yet. But there are other states and other cities throughout the U.S. where this is much more widely known and broadly established, both in the school system, in the juvenile justice system, and in other parts of the criminal justice system.
What are a couple of places in the country where this happens, and also if there are other places in the world that practice this?
Yes, there are. So one notable example is the country of New Zealand. I'll start with outside of the country. In New Zealand in the 80s, they changed their whole juvenile justice system over to a restorative justice model, which was based on Maori justice practices, because, in fact, in that country, as in this country, they were seeing disproportionate minority representation in the juvenile justice system. So there were a lot of Maoris who were being impacted by their retributive system. So they changed the system, and since then they have succeeded in closing every single juvenile detention facility in the country. So it's completely changed the way they do justice and the outcome for the young people that were very severe and long-lasting before. They no longer incarcerate young people in that country, and they seem to be doing a perfectly good job terms of preventing crime and addressing the consequences when it occurs.
Well, doesn't that assume a smaller population, a less complicated population, and less diverse population, and it's pretty homogeneous there. I mean, there are certain sets of values that are pretty similar, but if you get a city like New York City, for instance, where you get like 50 different sets of values and how many different diverse populations with different traditions, how can you compare the two?
Could you compare the two? I think that there are lessons that we can learn from New Zealand's experience. And I started with New Zealand because it's a good countrywide example, but there are cities throughout the U.S. that are more diverse, like Chicago and Oakland, California, and Atlanta, Georgia, Minneapolis, where restorative practices have been implemented in a variety of different ways. In the criminal justice system, in the juvenile justice system, and in schools. And there are states such as Vermont and Minnesota where the state has adopted restorative practices on a statewide level.
Mm-hmm.
So there are programs throughout the state. Vermont has a whole parallel system of community justice centers where run largely by community volunteers, where community volunteers get directly involved in various programs dealing with people who have been accused of doing harm in the community.
Accused or actually... you mean like arrested and then tried and convicted or... pled guilty
yeah.
to, or
is the, pro- that- the programs come into play at different stages of the criminal justice system.
Okay.
All
right.
But yes.
So there's this whole idea of I think that when we talked once before, before we decided to do the interview on the air here, there is also restorative justice that could come from this between the state and from large groups of people or citizens that were harmed. Is that part of it? In other words, like the United States and the way it locked up all the Japanese citizens on the West Coast, or you could pick anything, the United States and descendants of slavery or American Indians or what happened. Yes. I'm sure a lot of these things have not occurred. Obviously, they haven't. The United States using the atomic bombs on Japan. There's a million examples like this all over the world. Sure. All the time. So how does restorative justice get involved in this, or does it?
Well, restorative justice is a broad umbrella term. It encompasses a range of different practices. And one of the things included in restorative justice is the truth and reconciliation process, which most people are familiar with from South Africa. But there have actually been a number of truth and reconciliation processes that have taken place in North America. So, and currently, there are a number of restorative justice practitioners and advocates in this country who have been calling for a truth and reconciliation process to address state harms against African Americans. Mm-hmm. So if you look up Fania Davis, who's a practitioner in Oakland, California, she's the founder of an organization called Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth. She's written extensively about this. And it's worth noting that Canada recently had a truth and reconciliation process related to residential schools where generations of First Nations people were rounded up and sent away to these very harsh boarding schools where they were physically abused and stripped of their language and their culture systematically. And the Canadian government has recently actually offered reparations as a result of this process. So there are a lot of ways that this idea, that this concept and these practices can be used to address large-scale state-sponsored harm.
You're listening. This is Mike Fader with Turning Point, and you're listening to Mika Dashman, who is the founder and lead organizer for the Restorative Justice Initiative. And it's the website is restorativejusticeinitiative.com. What?
It's actually restorativejustice.nyc.
Restorativejustice.nyc. Okay. Let me ask you this.
And I do want to say also that my website has a resources page where I've compiled a whole bunch of different articles and videos and films and books and webinars. So if any of your listeners are interested in learning more about this subject, mm-hmm. It's a great starting point.
Well, but as you say, this is practiced in various parts of the world and practiced in certain places in this country. Give me a couple of examples about how this has worked and how it would work. Let's just make it sort of very personal. Let's say somebody in my family or your family, God forbid, was murdered, or there was a rape or a child molestation or something like that. And this is by somebody who's, let's say, somebody who's done these things before, and what happens? This person is arrested, evidence is established, they're convicted or they plead guilty, there's a sentence, and you say it happens at different stages of it, but what?
Correct.
What would happen here? I mean, you would have to have one side, you'd have to have both sides sincerely involved and wanting to wanting to participate in this, not wanting to be left out of this. But basically, we're talking about victims here, not the perpetrators. The perpetrators expect what they get. It would be almost a gift to them, wouldn't it? I mean, would they'd still have to serve time or be punished for what they did, wouldn't they? I mean, I'm asking a lot of questions at once, but give me a couple of examples of really, really terrible crimes where people have been involved and altered the outcome, and what is expected of both sides?
Well, anytime you're talking about a dialogue process that involves victims and offenders, particularly if it's a crime of severe violence, those cases are screened very carefully. And one of the things that they look for is a sense of remorse on the part of the defendant. and their willingness to meet with their victim and to make things right. And it really has to be victim-initiated. So there is restorative justice programs do not coerce victims mm-hmm. who are not interested or ready to meet with people who have harmed them. That's not something that happens. So,
but this, so in other words, if they're not ready, you know, right after the crime or for, let's say, years, could they be ready years down the line and get involved?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that I was going to say about victim-offender dialogue is that those processes usually happen after sentencing mm-hmm. when the responsible party is already incarcerated. So the dialogue that happens doesn't impact the sentence or the consequences for the defendant at all. That's not what it's about. It's about the healing process for both the victim and the offender.
You know, I was a probation officer for many years for the city and the state of New York and the city of New York, and I interviewed victims of crimes, and I interviewed what were called offenders, people who had been convicted or pled guilty of crimes. And some of them were very, very serious, awful crimes. I rarely saw any remorse. So I guess when you say screening for actual remorse, you have to have people who are expert in seeing whether or not some of these people who could be very psychopathic and say, you know, or produce tears on demand, you'd have to really see whether they really meant it and then bring them together with a family who was ready. It's a difficult process, right?
Yes, and I think that people who do those screenings know what to look for. But you also have to remember that once somebody has been sentenced and is serving their time, they may very well be sort of in a different place mentally and psychologically than they were at the stage when you saw them. So they may have had more time to think about it, and you know, they may be feeling differently. But again, it always has to be initiated by the victim. And I think that it's also important to remember that the system that we have doesn't encourage accountability. I mean, we have this myth in our culture that punishment equals accountability. But it doesn't really work that way, because actually the more harshly you treat somebody who has harmed somebody else, the more you take away their basic rights and liberties and treat them with harshness, the more likely they are to feel victimized, to feel defensive, and to not really be focusing on the harm that they've done, but rather to be focused on how they've been victimized by the system itself.
So the system,
and you see that again and again within the criminal justice system when you are, you know, when you're talking to criminal defendants.
So the system just assumes, when we say the system, I guess it's, I don't know, the state as separated from the way the general public feels, or the state maybe as representative of the general public. The system recognizes punishment as the end of the that's it. When somebody does something and they're punished a certain way, that's all that's going to happen. But it doesn't take into account the let's have an example. Somebody kills somebody in a robbery, or thoughtlessly, or they were drinking and driving, or some other version of that, you know, some terrible thing, and it's not even personal, or let's say it is personal, but somebody murders somebody else and it's clear that they did it. Then somewhere along the line, what happens next? The family would contact somebody?
There are a number of states around the country that have established victim offender dialogue programs, so there's someone that crime victims and victims' families can call if they want to engage in this process. We don't have that here in New York. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, what that means is that if the victim of a crime or their family member want to engage in some kind of direct dialogue process, they will need to go to the prosecutor and actually educate the prosecutor in most cases mm-hmm. about this possibility and then advocate for it.
Well, so let's say
let's make it happen.
Let's say there's a place where this actually is established as a procedure that can be used. So the victim goes. I think you mentioned. Is it Minneapolis? I forget. Minnesota, rather, or Vermont.
Let's take Texas as an example, because Texas is one of the first states to actually develop victim offender dialogue programs, which was something that was very much initiated by the victims' rights community there.
Okay, so you go to whatever the office is or the part of the state of Texas, and you say, we're the family of the victims of the crime in this case where, let's say, our daughter or our son was killed, was murdered, and what's the next step?
Well, then a facilitator would be assigned, somebody who is trained to facilitate dialogues in violent crime, and that person would meet over a period of time with the victims and with the defendant. And so there's extensive preparation involved. Each side has an opportunity to tell their story, talk about how they were impacted and what they want to get out of the process to the facilitator individually before they're ever brought together in the same room.
Okay. So they both express their points of view extensively and say what they would like to see, what they expect, or maybe they're even told what's expected from them, and then sooner or later they get together in a room with the facilitator.
Yeah, and the dialogues are generally held in a correctional institution because mm-hmm. the offender is incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. So when the two groups get together, have you ever been involved in one of these ever?
I haven't, because again, we don't have it here.
Okay, but what happens then when people get together in a room? The family, the family of the victim of a murder gets together with the person who committed the murder, and there they are sitting across from each other at a table, and there's the facilitator. What is expected, or what comes from this, or what might be an outcome? What would be the responsibility of the perpetrator and the responsibility of the victims?
Well, usually the victims have things that they want to say to the defendant, and they also have questions, things that they want to ask. So they'll usually be given the opportunity to speak first. They talk about how they were impacted. Sometimes they may offer forgiveness. You mentioned before that that's a value for many people. Mm-hmm. It isn't a value for all people, and it's not something that is ever required of a victim in a restorative justice process. If they want to offer forgiveness, that's up to them.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the defendant will ask for forgiveness. Again, it's up to the victims whether they want to offer it. And, you know, there are often many detailed questions that they have about the circumstances of the crime, things that maybe didn't come out at trial, if there was a trial, or things related to the state of mind of the defendant at the time, mm-hmm. or the circumstances of his or her life that led up to the commission of the crime, that didn't come out at trial or didn't come out previously. And these are things that they want to know, because often for people in that situation, sort of getting a picture of the defendant as a human being who has been shaped by a certain set of life circumstances and experiences is helpful, as opposed to thinking of them solely in the context of this one horrible act.
Some kind of incomprehensible monster or something like that. People are always looking to make sense of the irrational, and even more so if it's a shocking or sudden or violent thing. I guess. So then what happens? I mean, is the sentence still remains? I mean, what is expected finally if these two sides manage to really communicate with each other or understand each other, or forgiveness is often is offered and it's, let's say, taken by what is that? What is then the actual responsibility of the offender? Do they do anything, or do they just have this conversation and that's it?
It really depends. It's very individual. So, some people who have been through this process choose to have some kind of ongoing relationship with each other. You know, they continue to write, they continue to visit. I know of people who have actually, victims' families who have actually, sort of taken the defendant in as a member of the family, as if they were a member of the family. But it's really entirely up to the individuals involved. Sometimes having this one meeting is enough. Mm-hmm. They feel like that brings closure and healing to them, and they, never want to have any contact again. So what the responsibility of the offender is depends on what the victims ask of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, might they say that they would like to not just hear an expression of remorse, or that, this person is sorry, that, or explanation of whatever the crime was, but they would expect them to either on some work release program or after they get out, after they're paroled or whatever, that they would dedicate themselves in a certain way to talking to other people or educating people about what they did or...
Sure.
I mean, how would that be? I mean, what kind of details?
Yeah, that isn't usually mandated, but it's certainly something that the family can ask.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned this to you when we spoke before, but there was a murder case in Florida a number of years ago in which the family of the parents of the young woman who was murdered by her boyfriend. They were close to the parents of the defendant in the case, and they initiated something a little unusual that I think hasn't really been done before or since, but they called it a restorative plea conference. So actually at the stage of the criminal process where normally the lawyers would meet, and it would be sort of like horse trading in terms of negotiating a plea deal. They brought in a restorative justice facilitator who joined the defense team and was able to facilitate this dialogue between both sets of parents and the defendant, in which the parents of the murder victim were able to offer their forgiveness. That was something that was important to them, to the young man, and to ask him questions about what occurred on the night of the crime and the days leading up to it. And they did actually ask something very specific of him. They felt very strongly that their daughter would have accomplished much good in her life had she lived. And they felt that it was important for him to know that because he was responsible for taking her life, he now had a responsibility to do the good work of two people for the rest of his life. And one of the ways that they suggested that he could begin to fulfill that obligation was to do speaking engagements with them and to talk about the crime and to do public education about the dangers of violence in relationships between young people. So he, in that case, my understanding is that he was able to get special release privileges. He's serving 20 years in prison, but he is able occasionally to leave the correctional facility to go out for the specific purpose of doing these educational talks with his victim's parents.
Wouldn't you say this whole idea, this whole thing that you're describing, this one example, and the whole concept of restorative justice and the victims of, let's say, we're talking about serious crimes here, not somebody who got their pocket picked. I mean, we're talking about, let's say, child molestation or rape or something that changes the life of the victim or changes the lives of, let's say, in a murder case, of the victim's family in such a permanent way as that nothing ever seems quite right after that. And people's lives can be sort of psychologically twisted to the point where they can hardly live right after that. And in any case where there's a violent crime like that or an ongoing really awful crime, wouldn't you say that it's really unusual? The whole idea of restorative justice, it's an unusual victim or family of victims who would get involved in a thing like this, isn't it?
I don't know. I don't know that we can say that, actually. I think that we can't actually make an assessment of what most victims want when we're only offering them one option. And in fact, our current justice system often has a way of silencing or sidelining the voices of victims who are not seeking punishment or retribution. So I think that if we began to offer more options to victims, even victims of violent crime, we might begin to see that there's actually more diversity of opinion than it currently appears.
So this would have to be made, the knowledge that this, first of all, these programs would have to be set up as official legal programs in each state or, let's say, in each city. And then people would have to be made aware of the fact that they could get involved in this, right? Because my experience, and I've been in courtroom situations where sentencing occurred, and what I've often seen is, rather than somebody crying and saying, I wish I could speak to these people, and I wish, to the offender, I wish I could... What I've heard is people yelling and screaming in court, you know, put them in the electric chair or, you know, you should kill them for your it's directly to the defendant till they're removed from court to the offender. You know, you should die and go to. I mean, I've heard a lot of violence and feelings that the sentence wasn't even harsh enough from people in courtrooms to the extent where people have to be removed from the courtroom, you know. That's why I mentioned it seems almost unusual.
I mean, I think that is a common reaction. And, you know, people are very much entitled to their personal responses to harm.
Right.
I think the larger question is on what values do we set up our system for redressing harm? Do you set up a system for redressing harm based on a punitive, retributive paradigm that doesn't actually effectively accomplish the goals that it sets out to accomplish, or do you offer something that may actually provide more meaningful accountability?
Well, maybe there are society. Obviously, it seems to me that although you mentioned that there is an increasing amount of this of these offices and procedures established for restorative justice, this country is, as far as I can tell, and a lot of other countries, but especially this country is And you pick Texas, for example. I mean, they're well known for executing a lot of people. In other words, the idea that you have to be severely punished, and this is aside from the fact that people are suffering cruel and unusual punishment sometimes for crimes in the prison system. But the idea that there has to be retribution, or people have to, quote unquote, pay for what they did. And that's an interesting word, because there's different ways of paying, aren't there? The idea,
right.
The idea of vengeance and retribution seem to be, even though the country sometimes calls itself, or some people call it a Christian country, quote unquote, it seems to me that people have to pay. The whole idea is that you have to pay for what you did. But this idea of payment doesn't extend to contacting the victims in any way, or paying in a way which is more humane. And in the end, as you, and the word itself says it, to restore any humanity on either side.
That's correct. And also what has become increasingly clear is that not all members of our society are held to account within that system and mm-hmm. forced to pay for their wrongdoing in equal measure, right?
So yeah, I just
there
actually
are all sorts of inequities within the system
right.
That have resulted in it having a disproportionate, you know, a small segment of the population have borne a disproportionate amount of the punishment meted out by that system.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I just got a cue from the engineer that we only have a couple of seconds left. So I wanted to reintroduce you. It's Mika Dashman, Ms. Mika, M-I-K-A, Dashman, founder and lead organizer of the Restorative Justice Initiative, and it's restorativejustice.nyc?
Yes, that's the website.
And is there a way on the website they can contact you? Because we're just about out of time here.
Yes, there's a contact form. And we're also actively soliciting donations from individual donors and foundations. So if any of your listeners would like to give to support our work, we would be very grateful.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on and explaining this. And it would be a massive sea change in the way that the country treats crime and punishment. Thank you once again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Mike. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Okay, we'll be back next week.
Through the garden, you better watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon for the straight and narrow track. If you walk with Jesus, he'll save your soul. You gotta keep the devil. The fire and the fury at his command. Well, you don't have to worry if you hold on to Jesus' hand. We'll all be saved from Satan when the thunder rolls. You gotta keep the devil. About you.